on the computer. But
the House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues, I apologize for starting 5 minutes late. We will attempt to start on time from now on, as you know we have been doing in the past. I want to welcome members of the Senate who are sitting with us this morning. One back in her old chair. Welcome, Representative, Senator Rosenbaum. And we'll move right ahead then with the agenda, which is an informational meeting. Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of both committees, during the February session, you passed Senate Bill 1082, which directed the Department of Revenue to prepare a report on personal income tax compliance and report to you by February 1. And you have the report before you. And Director of the Department, Elizabeth Harchenko, is here to talk with you about the report. Before she does that, though, she was going to go through some background on administrative issues that the department faces and its general program. So we're going to cover the issue of compliance really in two segments, kind of an introductory issue discussion about the programs the department has, some of the issues they've encountered, and then to focus on the report itself in the second half of her presentation.
Thank you. And welcome this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Chair Barnhart, Chair Burdick, members of the committees, for the record, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. As Paul said, I'm here to cover a couple of different aspects of the department today. You have a document that is entitled Department of Revenue Agency Overview. That's what I'll begin with. Probably will not be able to touch on everything in that document, but to give you a flavor for the administration of the tax laws that are enacted by the legislature and how we operate as an organization doing your business. And then I'll move into the report on tax compliance. After that, I'm going to try to reserve most of the time for the tax compliance report, assuming that that's where your primary interest is and where most of the questions will lie. The mission of the Department of Revenue is to make revenue systems work to fund public services, and we try to remember that every day in what we do and how we administer the tax laws, that it's the purpose of that is to fund education, to fund public safety, to fund human services. And our employees understand that, and they try to make sure that taxpayers understand that as well. As an organization, because we are responsible for collecting large amounts of money, dealing with confidential information, and people really don't have a choice about working with us, we bring several very high-level values to our work every day, and I've listed those in the document. We have to be ethical, honest, and have very high integrity, or taxpayers will not trust us with their information. We work very, very hard to try and make the systems that we're responsible for work effectively for taxpayers as well as efficiently for us. We have to be accountable to you for the resources that you give us and also for the funds that we collect. We have to treat each other and taxpayers respectfully and professionally. And we also are striving to continuously improve the systems that that we use to administer taxes. We're in the process, I'm moving to page 2 of that document, we're in a process right now of setting a new vision for ourselves. We've just begun that process, and in December we reaffirmed our mission statement and our values, and created a vision statement for ourselves over the next 5 to 7 years, which is to become a model of 21st century tax administration through the strength of our people, our technology, our initiatives, and our innovation and our service. And so we are beginning to go through a transformation process. So I'm going to be talking to you a lot about what we do today, and I will try to inform you as I do that where we see significant change going forward. The key issues for us are going to be to modernize our technology, continue to strengthen our workforce, and identify the skill sets that we're going to need in the future to run our business. and to look hard at our business processes to make sure that they work as efficiently and effectively for taxpayers and for us as is possible. I've identified for you some of the key issues in our 2009-11 budget. They are pretty much the standard ones. How to continue to improve compliance by using better tools, working more closely with our business partners, both at the federal level in other states and here in Oregon, continuing to upgrade and update our technology, and continuing to improve the way that we operate our processes. I have a list there of some of the very specific projects that we've been working on, and they cover the gamut of our programs, which I'll talk to you about in a minute. A key for us is going to be information technology transformation. The systems that we have today were built beginning in the early 1990s using the technology that was then leading edge. It's now come to the end of its expected useful life was built at a time when there was no internet, there was no World Wide Web, and so we've got to now have technology that enables us to use those tools. We also are seeing a continuing evolution in our administration of the tobacco programs, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Page 5 of the document gives you a picture of our organization. The circle is our management team, which consists of myself, my deputy, my administrators, and my chief information officer. We have 4 large divisions within the organization. Our administrative services provides internal support, human resources, our finance and accounting area, our processing center, and our information technology. The other 3 divisions are focused around program and taxpayers, property tax program, the personal income tax program, and then taxes that we administer that touch businesses. And in that area, we're talking about corporation and estate programs, a variety of smaller tax programs, and collections that are related to business. We have a number of field offices so that we have presence in community, and out of 3 of those offices, we also have some satellites where we just have a couple of staff who are housed in usually another state building, perhaps with the Department of Human Service or the Department of Employment, to provide presence in some of those smaller communities. Turning to page 6, the largest program or programs that we administer obviously are the income tax programs, at least for your general fund, and we perform a number of tasks with respect to those programs, educating and assisting taxpayers in understanding what their obligations are and how to meet those obligations when their taxes are due. Of course, we prepare forms and publications, information on the web. We provide information over the telephone, through email, and we have quite a bit of correspondence. We process tax returns. We process payments. We bank funds. And then on the sort of compliance enforcement end of the spectrum, we audit returns, collect taxes that are due and unpaid, and seek filing from people who haven't filed their tax returns. It's projected that for this coming biennium, those 2 programs will be 94% of your state general fund. This is what we call in the agency the big gorilla program, because it's the single largest in terms of the amount of effort and energy we put into, and obviously such a huge contributor to the general fund. On page 7, try and show you just the way in which the funds that come in from those 2 programs do come in. 2/3 are coming in through the actions of employers and employees identifying withholding and reporting and remitting that every pay period. We have about 14.5% coming in through taxpayers self-identifying that they have taxes due and making estimated payments. About 15.5% come in with returns, and our enforcement efforts bring in a final 2.5% of the total dollars that we collect. We have some just some quick facts for you about those two programs to give you an idea of sort of the size. We received last year in 2008 when we processed the 2007 tax returns, 1.8 million individual income tax returns. We were thrilled with the fact that 60% of those came in electronically because that is very, very efficient for us. It allows us to process returns more quickly, and if a taxpayer has a refund, get a refund out much more quickly than when a paper return is filed. We use a tool that was developed in Indiana and that we've been using for a number of years now, that if a person prepares a tax return using computer software but prints it out and sends it in on paper, the software is required to have programming in it that creates a barcode, just like in the grocery store on a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk. And that barcode can be scanned using a laser. So the paper comes in, we have to open it, but then once we scan it with the laser, it's as if it was an electronic return for the purposes of the rest of the processing operation. So it saves us data entry, and it saves us filing and paper routing. We're down to about 21% of income tax returns that are coming in on paper, prepared without using software, and those we're still doing manual data entry, but we're exploring ways to convert those also to electronic as quickly as we can. As they're filed, we review about 11% of returns. The percentage is much higher for self-prepared returns than it is for those that are prepared using software or by a filed electronically. A lot of times what we find is arithmetic errors or things that are obvious from the face of the return where there's a limit. For example, the deduction for federal income taxes is limited by statute, and if a taxpayer claims more than that, the computer just automatically adjusts it and sends a notice to the taxpayer. After filing and we've processed returns, then we do have the audit function. For the last fiscal year, we audited over 33,000 personal income tax returns, and that's when a tax auditor actually takes the return, reviews it, works with the taxpayer to get documentation for items of income or deduction, and issued about almost $49 million in assessments from those audits. We also reviewed working family credit claims. Those are refundable credits and can amount to significant amounts of dollars going out, so we do review them when they come in to make sure that the taxpayer is eligible, that the child care expenses they're claiming are documented, that the child care expenses are in fact eligible for the credit and that they've calculated it correctly. And we have adjusted working family credit claims in the $3 to $4 million range every year since the credit became deductible. We have a pretty robust filing enforcement effort that we make, and again, over the last fiscal year, we worked with over 14,000 taxpayers to try and get them to file returns that they should have filed but did not. And we have basically about a third of them, once we contact them, they get it together and do file. Some don't have to file because of their income levels, and in about 42% of the cases, we try to determine, based on the information we have, what their liability is and send them a bill, even though they have not filed a return. And then we have to work with them, if they then come forward with more information, to adjust the liability to what they actually owe. We also collect dollars from taxpayers who file returns but don't remit the taxes that they should have remitted, and also collect from taxpayers who haven't who didn't file at all. On the corporate program, we have about a little over 83,000 taxpayers. We've had the 2D barcode system available for corporate for a couple of years, and just last year made electronic filing available for corporations without any real public fanfare about it. 5% of those returns actually did come in using the electronic system, and we're really looking forward to see how the use of that grows this year. We also review those returns for errors and do audits. The audits are at kind of two levels. We audit cooperatively with other states, very, very large corporations that are doing business across the country and in many states, and then we also do regional and local corporations. And we also have some filing enforcement work that we do at the corporate level because some corporate taxpayers don't file in Oregon when they should. And when we locate them, then we contact them to get those returns. Mr. Chair, I would ask that if anyone has questions, they please interrupt me. You don't have to save them till the end. Just kind of tell me to be quiet.
Thank you.
And ask. Thank you. On page 9, this balanced approach now is the first connection point to taxpayer compliance that I want to be sure that I call to your attention. We have, as I said, just in the individual income tax, 1.8 million returns coming in, taxpayers who need to understand what their filing obligation is, how to calculate their liability, and where to send it and when it's due. And so we use a three-part approach to trying to maximize taxpayers doing it right by themselves. The whole system really depends on taxpayers initiating on their own, filing, calculating their liability, and paying. And so we try to get information out as effectively as we can so that they're able to do that. We have, of course, paper forms. You're probably all familiar with paper tax return forms. We have booklets. We have information circulars on things that are fairly complicated. We have everything also on the Internet. People come into our field offices and call our call center for help with more complicated issues. And we also work closely with tax practitioner groups and accountants to keep them up to date on Oregon law requirements and changes and the work that we're doing to try to make sure that as they work with their clients that they are achieving the best in terms of the initial voluntary compliance happening accurately. We do offer some assistance for taxpayers. We're not able to help everyone, but we have our 7 field offices, our 3 satellite offices, and a call center to try to answer questions for taxpayers so that they're able to do things correctly as much as possible. And you have some statistics there on the contacts that we have in the course of the process. Then the last piece is enforcement, and I mentioned that when I talked about the income tax programs, that collections, auditing, and filing enforcement are the big areas in which we work. We have quite a few staff doing that work for us, but that is the most labor-intensive, and it requires one-on-one contact with taxpayers. So the more people we can move into that voluntarily, self-initiated, doing it right, doing it on time, then the more we can, we're able to influence the group that isn't working that way. We have a number of agencies with whom we partner in terms of achieving our objectives as well as theirs when they're linked. Whether it's the Employment Department, because we work with employers on taxes related to payroll, as do they, the Board of Tax Practitioners, so that their licensees are fully informed and able to provide the best advice to their clients, the Board of Accountancy, other state tax agencies, the Internal Revenue Service, and we use private collection agencies also to help us with our collection function. So a number of partnerships at all levels. When we talk with the Ways and Means Committee, we try to give them some background about the things that affect our programs and the way that we do our work and that we try to pay attention to and adapt to over time. The changes in our population, both whether it's income level, it's age, it's comfort with technology or lack of comfort with technology, language differences, cultural differences, we have to be aware of and alert to because it does affect how we help taxpayers comply. Obviously, changes in federal tax law, as they either flow through automatically to Oregon or as the legislature decides it's going to connect or not connect to federal tax law changes. You have to flow those through because of the way that we are what we call piggybacked onto the federal tax system. Oregon income taxpayers and corporate taxpayers begin with their federal tax federal taxable income line from their federal return, and then make Oregon adjustments, apply Oregon credits, and report their liability. It allows taxpayers not to have to start all over again on their own return, and allows us to use information that's already being collected by the service. But we do have some differences, and for a variety of reasons, and we have to make sure that those are clear. Changes in what's going on in the business world obviously affects our administration, whether it's employers coming into business or going out of business, global competition, use of different forms of business organization that for tax purposes aren't taxpayers, but the tax liability and income and expense flows through, creates issues for us. Obviously, taxpayer expectations about use of technology and e-commerce and tax planning are all things that affect the way that we have to look at administering the business that you've given us to do. Other things that we consider that are very, very important to us as we look at where we place the resource that you've given us is how do we sustain the long-term health of the income tax program, because that's what keeps the revenue stream as steady and predictable as possible in normal times, and also helps us to maximize compliance. We're conscious of the fact that that what we bring in funds so much of your general fund and the services that are paid for from that, and so being as efficient as we can and moving the dollars that we collect quickly into Treasury is also important to us, and then just making the system as efficient as possible for taxpayers and for us is important. I've already mentioned, I think, and I will be talking more again about compliance challenges. I touched on the refundable credits, e-file. Document management is something that we are trying to shift, as I said, from the minority of paper over to truly an electronic data set. I have a list of our 09 legislative concepts, but our legislative coordinators, Deborah Buchanan and John Phillips, will go over those with you as you consider those bills. Moving to page 14, I'd like to talk a little bit about our tobacco tax programs. We also do very similar functions with respect to the tobacco taxes, processing returns, banking payments, collecting overdue funds. The audit function tends to be more with respect to taxes on tobacco products other than cigarettes, and we also have inspections of retail sites to make sure that the tobacco products that are being sold in Oregon have had the tax paid. We have worked with the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Police on the law enforcement side, as there were some serious issues that we didn't have the ability to deal with just using administrative remedies over the last 5 or 6 years. And we're at a point where the task force members, looking at sort of what has been going on in compliance, agree that we could step back from the very intensive, co-located, dedicated resource to a little bit more informal on-call kind of a relationship. A lot of the issues that had arisen early on in the 2001 to 2004-05 timeframe, we've been able to resolve through law change and some, I think, good, fairly high-profile prosecutions of people who were selling untaxed product in the state. And it appears that we've got a pretty reasonable level now of compliance, at least that we would be detecting at the retail level. So we have stepped back from that, and we're still monitoring the issues. One issue that we will be wanting to talk to you about, and we've got a bill that you have scheduled next week, is just the manner in which the funding stream is provided for continuing cigarette and tobacco tax administration. In the past, in the distant past, before 2004, the legislature gave us a general fund appropriate. It seems like a long time. A general fund appropriation to administer the cigarette taxes.
You caught me smiling because it doesn't seem that long ago to me.
Oh, seems like a long time to me. Anyway, we had a general fund appropriation for many years for the cigarette tax, and then when the other tobacco products tax was enacted, we were given what's called a continuous appropriation of funds from the other tobacco products tax to pay the cost of administration of that program. And at the other end of the building, in the budget process, we would be given a limitation of how much of those dollars we actually could use based on our projected expenses. From 2004 until 2008, we were on the same we were moved to that structure for the cigarette tax administration and enforcement as well. In part, I think, because many of the programs and entities that receive funds from the cigarette tax are not in, it goes around the general fund, and it seemed appropriate for some portion of the cost of administration and enforcement to be borne by all beneficiaries from the programs. But there was a sunset that was put on that, and the sunset expired. And was not removed or extended in 2007. So for this budget cycle that we're in today, we received a direct appropriation from tobacco funds from the 2007 legislature. And the primary challenge for us was that we had a need that we wanted to try to address right away as it arose, which was taxpayers purchasing cigarettes over the internet from sites where the tax was not collected, and a requirement had been imposed that by the federal government that anybody that sold cigarettes into a state and didn't collect the tax had to report to the state. It was called the Jenkins Act, and so we wanted to put some resource into taking those reports and billing taxpayers for the unpaid tax, because that's the way the statutes are structured, and we didn't have the resources to do it. And if it hadn't been for the fact that you had a session in February of 2008, we would not have gotten the resources to do it, because there was no appropriation of tobacco resources into the emergency board to give us. And since we weren't operating on the expenditure limitation model, they couldn't give us permission to spend any more resources. So that's the policy issue that you'll be considering when you look at the bill. We do see a lot of dollars coming in through these programs, and clearly, one of the budget drivers will be whether there is a rate increase this time by the legislature. I know the Congress is very close to enacting a federal rate increase, which will affect sales. We also have a relationship here in the tobacco taxes with the Oregon tribes. Our tobacco laws, both the cigarette law and the other tobacco products law, authorize us to enter into agreements with the tribes so that they can sell taxed cigarettes, even though they're not required to pay tax on cigarettes that are consumed by tribal members. And then we have developed a formula to rebate the tax that is deemed to have been paid by tribal members who have purchased cigarettes on tribal land. It allows us to completely avoid a compliance problem of untaxed cigarettes flowing through the tribes. It provides a revenue stream for them, and it's worked very, very well on the cigarette side. We are just beginning negotiations with a tribe to talk about the other tobacco products side, and we'll report back as that goes forward. Pages 18 and 19 show you just some of the other programs that we administer, not nearly as significant in terms of dollars as the income tax programs, but nevertheless very important to the legislature. The inheritance tax, the tax that funds 911 service, a lodging tax that supports tourism, some fees and taxes that that are related to the environment. Under contract, we administer transit taxes for both TriMet and the Lane Transit District. We collect a large number of fines and assessments that are imposed through the judicial process. And we have a collections group that contracts with over 250 state and local agencies to collect debts that are owed to those organizations. It's called our Other Agency Accounts Program. And we have a court side in that group, and we also then have other agencies. We provide two kinds of services there. One is just offset against income tax refunds that are due, where we can just do a data match, and the other is a full collection service of using all the tools that we have in order to collect debt that's owed to state government. We administer two assistance programs. One is a property tax deferral program for seniors and people who are disabled. It's a self-funded program where the state pays property tax on behalf of eligible people, and when they sell their home, they repay the loan of those taxes. And to the extent that we have extra funds there, the legislature's directed us to send them to DHS for the Oregon Project Independence. We also receive a direct appropriation from the legislature to provide rental relief for very, very low-income elderly, and the appropriation that's in the budget this time is about $6.4 million. Those payments go out once a year. That appropriation also funds a what's called a funded property tax exemption for nonprofit homes for the elderly, and the dollars about half and half right now. Half of the dollars are being used for that funded property tax exemption. The other half are going out in the payments. I'm going to move off the income taxes and other taxes and move to the property tax program for a bit. This is a program where there's a partnership between local government and the state. Most of the property tax system is managed by county assessors and county tax collectors. In our 36 counties, they handle valuation of residences, valuation of commercial property and small industrial property. They handle the issuance of tax statements and the collection of property taxes and the distribution of those taxes to local governments. We support that work by providing services that require some technical expertise that not all counties have the resources to provide for themselves, and providing general oversight to assure that the system is administered as consistently as possible across the state. We have a group of folks that does valuation of complex property, utility property, and industrial property that's valued over $1 million. We have a mapping function where we contract with some counties and actually maintain their property tax maps, and we also are coordinating a project with the counties to create a digital map base across the state. We have our oversight process establishes standards, training, and assistance in just compliance with the annual cycle of the property tax system. And we're also responsible for establishing values for forest land that's assessed at the local level. The funds go a wide variety of places, and the funding stream is in part general fund, in part some funds that come in through document recording fees, and then if we have a contract with a county, for example, on a map project, then they are paying a portion of the cost of the project. We also administer a harvest tax on forest products and a small owner timber tax. I believe you had a report on that very recently. Page 22 gives you a visual that tries to show you the relationship between the counties and the state, where we have our support, sort of the roots of that tree, where we provide education, technical support for the counties. We manage the programs that I mentioned to you, and do training for boards that hear property tax appeals, do training on local budget law, and provide support on challenging appraisal problems that are still a county responsibility, and then also make sure that the counties have appropriate plans for managing their appraisals and their assessment and taxation function, and that that properties are being valued appropriately within their classifications. We share the timber, the mapping, and valuation functions, and then the counties, of course, are responsible for working with taxpayers locally and dealing with exemptions, special assessments, and the vast majority of numbers of accounts, because that is really the residential and commercial property. Let's move to page 24. And just wanted to give you an update. The ORMAP project was started in 1999 with an idea that the legislature embraced to give us $1 of recording fee data to share through a grant program with counties to bring our mapping system from what in many counties was a basically paper process up to digital, so that we could post through on the internet a statewide digital property tax map base that we can use for the property tax system, because each account is tied to a tax lot parcel, but that also could support over time geospatial information systems that are used by others, whether it's state agencies, local government, or the private sector. That project has been ongoing. We have an advisory board that works with us on policy, on eligibility for grants and direction. And it's really, even with the ups and downs in the economy that there have been over the last 10 years, we have 10 counties that have, when we had four goals to move through in order to get to the digital, completely digital. We have 10 counties that are there. We have 14 counties that are going to be there during this next biennium, and 12 that will be there in the biennium after that. And it's an incredible amount of work, because it involves not only people who do mapping, but it involves surveyors. It involves taxing districts. We've got things, of course, that lap over county lines that have to be matched up. And the commitment by assessors and in their mapping departments and by counties to the project has really been remarkable, and we've also had tremendous support from the private sector in participating on our advisory board, our advisory group. Just a little bit of data about the appraisal work that we do, the utility properties, about a $14.1 billion roll there each year, electric, gas, telecommunications, transportation, and that those values then we certify to the assessor, or to the assessors to go on the roll, and then the tax statements go out from the county and the funds are paid back to the county. The industrial roll is $16.2 billion this last year, and it's all kinds of different work: wood products, food products, electronics. The famous initiation for the new administrator is always taking them to appraise a fish processing plant. So our folks go out and visit those sites, determine value, keep track of additions and retirements of equipment and machinery, and again, we certify values back to the counties. We estimate that about $800 million a biennium of property tax revenue is dependent on our appraisal work. And on page 26 and page 27, you can see this county by county, sort of the real market value for those two property categories that we appraise. In the property tax, We have had a lot of conversation in the course of the interim as the question of whether the funding that has been coming from the federal government for many of the counties because of the presence of federal forest lands within those counties, that funding of county functions as well, including their assessment and taxation functions, has been a major concern. We have always issues with resources at the county level, and we're working constantly with assessors, particularly how best to balance the work between what we do for them and what they need to do in communities, so that we're as efficient in that process as possible. But they do have some challenges because of the complexity that has come into the system with the property tax limitations that have been enacted, particularly Measure 5 and Measure 50. Population growth and demographic changes also affect administration of the property tax system. Because funding for a portion of the system is related to document recording and fees on document recording, particularly documents related to construction and real estate, when interest rates go up or the volume of recordings go down, which is what we're experiencing right now, that funding stream varies and is reduced. And so we're watching that very, very carefully. It affects the counties as well as some of our work. Industrial property values seem to be the most sensitive to global competition, whether it's in wood products or food products or electronics. And we have to try very hard to keep up with that and discern whether and how it affects valuation.
Thank you. I represent Vance.
In regard to these maps, perhaps you could clarify the numbers, because I can't quite figure out why they're so low. I think when we were listening to an earlier presentation, the total property value in Oregon is around $500 billion, and these numbers look way lower than that.
Well, these numbers are just for the accounts that we appraise. So the map on page 26 is of the $14 billion worth of utility property that we appraise. This is the distribution of that value across the counties. There's so much value out there that's residences, commercial property, and smaller industrial type of property. We don't appraise that, and so that's not reflected on these maps. This is just the accounts that we appraise directly. So that's why that statewide market value number is low on those two. We're trying to just give you a picture of the distribution of those accounts that we manage.
Thank you. I understand now.
Similar types of budget drivers as for any tax program. The economy, complexity of the system, being able to work effectively with our business partners, technology, and trying to make sure that the system remains healthy over time. I want to talk for a couple of minutes about the building blocks that are going to lead me into the compliance report, and then ask for 2 minutes to turn on the computer and get a glass of water. Page 29. As I mentioned when I began, we have undertaken during this last year a strategic visioning process for ourselves. We have relied on and used, I think, as effectively as we can, the systems that were designed and built in the early 1990s. They've served us very, very well. They still do, but they don't provide the opportunity for innovation and significant productivity gain that newer business processes and technology support for those processes offer us. So we've begun what we believe is going to be transformational work. Starting with, as I said, the reevaluation and recommitment to our mission and our values, the creation of that vision statement, and the identification of some areas where we know that we need to work, and we need to begin to change the thinking, the way that we think about what our business is and how we do our business. And so what you see on pages 29 and 30 are those goal areas seven goal areas related to our people, creating a culture of constant improvement, being sure that we're striving for high-quality business results, that we focus even more on who our customers are and how we create value for them as well as for us, looking for and strengthening our looking for new partnerships and strengthening the partnerships we have today, preserving and enhancing public confidence in what we do and the way we do it, particularly around security of information, because the technology we're talking about is not as easy to control as the technology that we use now. And going to web-based service is very, very attractive, but it has risks that having a computer locked up in the heart of the building doesn't create. So we've also got to be sure that we are doing that. We also want to be sure that we're communicating as effectively as possible with taxpayers, and that we're not only doing things right, but we are also doing the right thing. And then the last area, obviously, is focusing on compliance, both taxpayer-initiated, doing it on time, doing it right, and then collecting those taxes that are due under the law when taxpayers don't self-initiate. The bullet points underneath those strategic goals we've referred to sort of as breakthrough concepts, but really I talk about it in the agency as these are the indicators of how we need to think differently about the way that we do our business. We've been a careful organization. We've looked for incremental productivity gain steadily over time. We know that as we give our people more tools, automated tools to do their work, they are more productive, they are more effective. And the emphasis has tended over the last 20 years to be more on internal efficiency. We see now the opportunity to really create external efficiency for taxpayers as well and create and have that be a win-win on both sides of the relationship. And technology is going to be a key to that. What we need to do next is first say, how are we doing things today? How do we want to do them differently? What's the path we need to take to move from where we are to where we want to go? What business cases do we need to develop so that we're sure that as we propose to invest in new technology, we know we'll get a return on that investment, what that will be, and that we will manage those projects effectively so that they do achieve the goals that we set for them. We've shared over the last several biennia our business plan with you, and the next step is going to be integrating the initiatives that we see that we need to undertake in connection with this new vision with that plan. There will be some things that people have set a lot of store by that we probably will set aside in favor of things that are more consistent with the direction that we want to go. And we'll be having that conversation in the agency and trying to then also set out over what period of time, what we start first, and we will definitely be back in the interim and in the 11th session to talk about what we're doing and what resources we need to apply to it. So I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about administration.
I do have a couple of questions. So before you wrap up, maybe okay. We can get to those, and
sure.
Then we'll let you wrap on this. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very, very quickly, I'm one of the first to say, yes, let's look at new technology and upgrade our technology. That's what I do. But I also want to be very careful because I've seen a lot of times where we upgrade technology and the purpose is not really all that clear, and we do it just to upgrade. And I want to be sure that we have a real business plan, a plan which either reduces expenses or increases revenue before we start putting in any new plan, any new technology. I just wanted to get that out and get your response to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that was why I made the reference to doing a business case, that for any investment that we propose to make, we need to do that analysis. What is it that we are planning to do? What are the outcomes that we expect? How are we going to measure those outcomes? what's the cost benefit and the total cost of ownership of a new system over time, and to come back and report to the legislature that what we're going to do and what the outcome of the business case analysis is. It's something that I think state government has learned through some painful experiences over time, that we have to think extremely carefully before we ask for significant amounts of resource to invest in technology. At the same time, we have to recognize that the public expects us to interact with them in the same way that, especially as a financial organization, the closest analog for us is the banks. And people have that experience of, I mean, I do it. I do my banking 24/7. I never have to walk into a branch. And it's not unreasonable for taxpayers to expect that they should at least be able to make sure that a payment was applied correctly, that if they want to set up a pay plan with us, they don't have to talk to a human being on the phone, but that they can do it automatically. So it's going to be a dialogue that we will come back and bring those business cases for you so that we're not running off.
I agree that you know, the taxpayers have that expectation and a reasonable one. But I don't want to go there without some return.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be sure that we don't affect our revenue or in a negative way or cost more money just to make it handier.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I was going to say that I think the director is singing our tune about these issues that you've been discussing. We've been working for some time with other aspects of the tax system, trying to get exactly the kinds of things that you just described built into those approaches.
Mm-hmm.
That's right on. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 83,250 corporate filers, does that include the flow-through corporate entities as well, or is that just a C-Corp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the taxpayers that we refer to are not flow-through entities. They are entities that have tax liability at the entity level. So a C corporation, S corporations do have a minimum tax liability, but flow through, and so do LLCs and partnerships. So any entity that's disregarded for tax purposes is not in that count.
Okay,
thank you. Thank you. And are you ready to move on, or did you have some closing remarks on this segment?
I think what I wanted to say was this, that I first really do appreciate the opportunity to just talk to you about tax administration. Usually the conversation about what we do and how we do it and what it costs and what our objectives are as the administrator of the tax programs happens at the other end of the building. And so I'm grateful to have the opportunity to share that with you who are making the tax policy. What we want to do, and I believe that, you know, our staff who are here with you as you look at policy issues, is to try and bring administrative considerations to you if they're going to make a difference, so that if you have choices about a policy that might be easier for taxpayers to comply with or less expensive to administer, we offer you those options. And having an understanding of sort of just the big hydraulics in our program, I think will help you to make those decisions. So I hope that you will continue to ask us what we're going to do to carry out the policy proposals that you're considering, as you know, as well as just what impact are they going to have on taxpayers? Because I think it's both sides. For you to be fully informed.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought if you're not done.
No, no, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to sit with you today. This has been a good discussion. Just a couple comments. I want to say that, you know, because I'm not on Ways and Means, it's really great to see how much proactive compliance work the department is doing. I think that's really key, and it, you know, based on what I see here, it's really having quite a return for you. And I just want to pick up on the comment that you just made about, you know, being available on compliance issues and if there's ways that things can be made I would like to turn that around and invite you to be very proactive with us when it comes to tax policy. We have Senator Telfer is not here today from the Senate committee, but she's actually a CPA. And so we will have some independent voice on our committee, you know, from how it works from the standpoint of the actual taxpayer. And so I just want to encourage you to not be shy stepping forward when it comes to compliance issues, because lots of times that will determine the outcome of how successful a program is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's a great segue into the next portion of my presentation.
Thank you.
Absolutely perfect.
And if I could add you to stick the word administration in addition to compliance in every place where she put it, then she will have captured my thought completely. I think it's critically important that when your department sees something that we're doing that could be accomplished in a way that improves the odds of compliance and decreases cost of administration, that you not hesitate to let us know that proactively. And I think that's our agreement, but it never hurts to reemphasize it.
Mr. Chair, we will do our very best and in also trying to be responsive to the time constraints that you have also to work with. Sometimes we don't learn things until we actually try to put things into practice, and that's often why we come back 2 years later and say, could you please rethink this dimension? We do try to imagine what would we do, and to the extent that you're considering issues that we've been able to anticipate, we've been doing that thinking and having those conversations. And but as things come up that are a little new or a little different, we will do the best to think quickly and see if there are options that are administratively less burdensome on taxpayers and can be done more efficiently for us. But what I'm excited about is as we go through this transformation is sharing that with you during the interim so that you know what we're doing, how we're doing it, and why we're doing things the way that we are and can provide some objective outside question about, just as Representative Riley pointed out, is there really going to be a high-quality result here, a good return on the investment for compliance as well as taxpayer convenience?
Thank you. We'll take a 5-minute recess so we can set up for the second piece. Plan to reconvene immediately about 7 after 9. That will be in recess. Committee will come to order, and we're going to proceed with the director and the tax compliance report. Again, thank you very much for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, director of your Department of Revenue. I'm going to try being more technically savvy and actually use a PowerPoint presentation for this part. You have a slide deck in front of you so that you can follow. And then there's a really detailed report, but I very selfishly asked Paul not to give it to you so that you wouldn't dive into it and ignore me.
So would we do that?
I don't know, but some people are very visual. So I've got the slide deck. I will work with that. I have some talking points. I just will tell you right now, I don't expect to be able to get into all the depth that I know many of you would like me to get into. So the open invitation is, if you would like me to come and talk to you, bring my personal income tax administrator or key staff to talk to you individually about things that you're very specifically interested in, please ask us to do that. This is complicated stuff. We're still digesting some of what we've learned, and this is an ongoing process for us and in relationship to you as well. So I do not see this as an ending point, but a beginning point. You pushed us in a very important direction, gave us some impetus to work very, very hard over the last 8 months or so and learn a tremendous amount about what we know and what we don't know and identify some things we need to continue to pursue. So I just would like to set that context. I'd like to start with a couple of stories because what compliance is about, and for us compliance, as I said, is people knowing what they need to do and self-initiating doing it correctly and on time. Anything else is not compliance. So compliance for us isn't just limited to enforcement. It's the whole spectrum. Enforcement is one set of tools to achieve compliance. So, two stories. Kathy and John bought a small farm in Oregon in 1985 and built a new addition on their barn in 2008. They made some mistakes early on when they bought their property, and by failing to allocate their purchase price to the land and the buildings and the farmhouse. And by the time they are now getting ready to prepare their 2008 return, they're potentially claiming the entire cost of the barn addition as a deduction in 1 year, which they should have capitalized it over the life of the addition. They probably are not depreciating the buildings properly if they are including land value in that depreciation, because you don't depreciate land, and you also don't depreciate your personal residence. They also started using their truck for more than just farm business, but claimed all of the expenses related to the truck on the farm schedule F. Complex system, lots of rules, taxpayers trying to do it maybe all by themselves without the help of a preparer, unintentional errors, understating liability, and underpaying their tax. Other side of the coin, we have Tom. Tom is a mechanic. He's a very popular mechanic in his community because he gives discounts for people who pay in cash. And the cash goes in his pocket, and it never shows up on his income tax return. So, kind of bookends. People trying to comply, making mistakes due to complexity of the system. Somebody who's really not trying to comply, understating liability. Neither of those things are going to show up in glowing ink on a tax return. The only way you find that is by working actually directly with the taxpayer. As Paul said, this report is in response to Senate Bill 1082. We were told to estimate the level of individual income tax compliance by Oregonians, identify behaviors that contribute to noncompliance, and then talk to you about what we might do about it. So I'm going to talk to you about the process we went through, what our findings are,
and our recommendations. And we have three kinds of recommendations: what we can do and are starting to do now without resource or additional policy change, what you might consider as policy change to help us both right away, and then some things that we would want to bring back to you in 2011, and then resource-based changes, some that are in the governor's budget for 09-11, and things that we would be coming back in 2011. So the process. We researched broadly. We looked at the literature that's out there. We looked at studies that had already been done by other states. We did some surveys. We talked to other states and the IRS about their best practices. We contracted with Oregon State to do a taxpayer survey to get a sense of attitudes and perspectives of citizens. We did focus groups inside the agency working with the staff that we have who work on compliance, and got some information from consultants that we had been working with and other states had been working with as well. So now I'm going to see if I can make this work. The major themes of our study, or the report that we're making, are everybody has these problems. The IRS has compliance issues, we have compliance issues, and other states do. Income taxes are complex and present compliance problems. Trying to estimate the level of compliance is hard. And we tried to take advantage of work that had been done by the IRS as well as looking at what was done by other states. The level of compliance is something that is tied to a point in time, and it will vary over time, although we think that there's a fairly narrow band of compliance that people's behavior stays within. And as we go forward, trying to measure improvement in compliance is also going to be a challenge. I talked to you about the balanced approach and why that's important, and that's also a theme in our report. Some of the things that we've concluded, reinforced for us in all of the work that we've done, is that reports that come from others who are separate from the taxpayer, whether it's an employer withholding report or it's a 1099 from a mutual fund, third-party reporting about income items or deduction items dramatically increase taxpayers' compliance. And it's crucial to achieving compliance. The complexity of the tax code, as I tried to describe just a little bit to you in the story of Mary and John, contributes to noncompliance, both unintentional because taxpayers just aren't aware, or intentional because you can make things work together that weren't designed to work together, or at least intended to work together, to significantly reduce tax. We know that we need to optimize the way that we select cases for audit. We can't touch every taxpayer, and we need to see if there aren't some better ways for us to look for those cases that are likely to be the subject of significant noncompliance, and we also have to look at our processes. And our disclosure laws they are a barrier right now for our ability to fully partner with some of our sister agencies, particularly on compliance issues that we have in common. And so we'll be talking about a recommendation related to that later. Why estimating the compliance level is difficult is that only the taxpayer has all the information that they need to complete a tax return. They know what their income is, they know what their deductions are, and there's not on the return all of that validation and support. So whether it's a simple return with just wages and a few deductions or complicated with investments or business operations, we don't have the information to validate on the front end. The code is complicated. The system does rely on voluntary compliance by taxpayers. We don't know what they don't tell us. And we don't have easy ways to learn it. And we don't have the resources to look over everybody's shoulder. And then much taxpayer information isn't validated by third-party reporting. So these are the approaches that have been used and the results that that states have had and IRS have had in looking at compliance and trying to estimate rates of compliance. There are three sort of approaches and directions that different organizations have taken. One that just looks at adjusted gross income and tries to compare tax data to independent sources of that information, census data, and then the IRS did a pretty extensive study of 2001 tax returns. They released the data starting in 2005 of the estimate of percent of unpaid taxes based on review of a selection of tax returns. So we looked at these other states, Idaho, Minnesota, California, New York, Montana, and the ranges of misreporting or compliance that they thought that they had using different approaches and the IRS. And what you see is the range we would get if we used each of those three, so between kind of 80 and 90%. We decided that because of our tight connection to the IRS or the federal system, the piggyback and the similarity of our system to the federal system, that we would pursue the federal analytical framework to try to estimate Oregon compliance. So there are some limitations even to that analysis. One, it only looks at the legal sector of the economy. So income from illegal sources, although it is taxable under the federal code, wasn't a part of their study. So what people commonly call the underground economy or, you know, income from carrying on criminal activities are not a part of this study. And it also, its applicability for us does rest on some assumptions. That 2001, which was their data set, is fairly typical. That compliance levels remain steady in all economic climates, which we're not certain is it would be precisely true. And also that the misreporting percentages for the income and deduction items that they looked at would be the same in Oregon as on the federal level. The IRS looked at about...
Representative Berger?
I hate to interrupt you.
Oh, please do.
But the way this is written is confusing me.
Sorry.
Is the percentage is that are written on this chart percentages of compliance?
Yes.
But the IRS net misreporting percentage...
We didn't get the labels very good, did we?
Do you see where I'm confused?
Yes.
It would say that there would that would indicate that the misreporting was 82%, but it's really the compliance that's 82%.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think what we've got here is the label of the technique.
Yes.
It was a net misreporting percentage technique, and the result is a compliance level.
Thank you. I just wanted that on the record. I'm glad to see I wasn't the only one who's scratching my head.
I reached the conclusion that it had to mean that without asking the question, but it's good to have it on the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So that's the method we used was the net misreporting percentage method, and the compliance level that was produced by that method.
Thank you.
Was what's shown on the slide. And so, as I said, it appears that and these studies were done at different times using different tax year data, and so it looks like that 80 to 90% range is a reasonable range. The next slide is our calculation of the gap for 2006 data. We had taxpayers voluntarily reporting about $5 billion for the 2006 tax year. We had voluntary withholding payments that came in through employers that didn't get claimed on timely returns of about $284 million. Our enforcement efforts, audit, filing enforcement, collection, generated about $130 million, so that the net gap is about $1.2 billion based on the IRS analytical framework of if everybody was an angel and reported exactly what they owed, used very good accounting, and so all the income, all the deductions, everything was perfectly reported, there would have been $1.2 billion more reported than paid. It's a big number.
Chair.
Yes.
Are we going to get to the cost of this enforcement and collection?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the cost to us of enforcement and collection, I don't have it in the presentation, but I can certainly prepare some information. If as we talk about it, you have some guidance for me of what specifically you're interested in, we will definitely get it.
Part of what we're, if I may, Representative, part of what we're thinking about is trying to understand what advice we ought to be giving to the Ways and Means Committee as it considers your budget. I can tell you we've already given them some advice around the rebalancing for the balance of this biennium, mm-hmm. in which we've essentially told them reducing expenditures in this department may be iatrogenic. It may actually reduce our income, and therefore that might not be a good idea on an across-the-board kind of decrease. We've already given them that advice, mm-hmm. but I think when we're talking about budgets for the next biennium, then advice we might give the Ways and Means Committee would be useful to them.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
And that's sort of what you have in mind, isn't
where
it?
Where I was going.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you
yeah.
very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Call.
And just maybe this is a question for Paul, but I'd like to see if we have it, what the numbers look like for when we start to see a fall off in the risk reward, right? I mean, right now maybe we should put more into enforcement because we'll be generating more revenue, but at some point every dollar we put in is not going to see a dollar of taxes come back. I would like to see if what that looks like and what the kind of econometrics are there so that we can understand how much we should be spending to maybe get after more of this $1.2 billion that's out there.
Thank you. I think that refines the issue that we're absolutely interested in. And was there another hand? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'm actually going to have to leave shortly. And I was wondering if the Ways and Means people were scurrying to their dictionaries when you gave them instructions that involved iatrogenic. That's where I'll be scurrying as soon as I go back to my office.
Sometimes being a psychologist gets in the way.
I did want to plant one general question, and if you don't want to comment on this now, that's fine. But I think one of the criticisms of the overall tax compliance system that we're pretty familiar with is lax enforcement at a federal level, and therefore more and more of that responsibility having fallen on the states. I mean, to the extent that it seems like we used to be able to rely on federal enforcement, and then over time that has been reduced. So I'm not sure whether you see long-term trends of that trend changing, and if that would affect our ability to rely more on the feds and not have to do so much of it ourselves.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, that really is a very excellent question. We have seen over the last 10 years or so great swings in the emphasis by the IRS on taxpayer assistance and then to enforcement without seeming to maintain a balance. It appears that from some other information that we've got that the overall compliance rate doesn't swing dramatically, but even on the margins, it's obviously a significant amount of resource. We do take advantage of everything that we can that comes from the IRS. And some of the things that are the easiest and most efficient for us to process do arise from an IRS audit or an adjustment to a federal return in some other way that we get a report of. And so we are able to take advantage of that. They have the same kinds of resource constraints that, that we have, and that is that we will never be able to audit our way completely out of these challenges because, as you'll see as I go on, it can be spread out across a large number of tax returns, and there's not anything about the return that glows that tells us it's one that we should review. So they are always looking for the optimum of what should we focus on, where are the problems that are emerging that we're able to identify, and even more talking to the states about how do we use our resource so we don't duplicate effort and we also don't create significant gaps. It's a constant conversation. And it does require all parties, I think, to continue to participate actively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And there was another, Senator Riddick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The tax gap, and it may be farther in the report, and if it is, I apologize for moving your head, but on this net tax gap, that does not include the underground economy, just like your previous analysis, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it would not include income from illegal activity.
Okay.
Now, to the extent that when you use the phrase underground economy,
that's what
you're
I meant,
thinking
it's
about
illegal.
Cash, just cash payments for legal activity, some of that has been captured here. But if it's money earned from selling drugs or money earned from engaging in some other illegal type of activity, fencing stolen property or anything else, they were not trying to, they didn't have information that allowed them to even
okay, to
try
follow
to focus
just
on
briefly,
that.
Mr. Chair, how did you get at the legal underground economy in this?
Well, as I'll go through the sort of how this analysis works.
I won't move you forward.
It was basically they reviewed 45,000 taxpayer returns selected from the national pool and did a pretty intensive review of all those returns to try to get a sense of the proportion of misreporting of the line items, wages and salaries, pensions, capital gain income, other kinds of income, deduction items, and then extrapolating from that sample and looking at what their audit results were after they evaluated those returns to then move to a here's what we think is a misreporting percentage for this category of income or deduction and then draw some broad conclusions about what was going on nationally. So they too had to make some assumptions about whether they found everything, so for example, as they looked at wages and salaries and underreporting of wages and salaries, they probably did touch on some cash payments that were made to someone that weren't reported either by the person who performed the services and was paid or the person for whom the services were performed and who made the payment. So a portion of the misreporting percentage for wages and salaries is cash payment for services. And that would be the way that legal activity that's conducted in cash would be reflected in some of the underreporting percentage.
Representative Vance.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I almost hate to ask this question, but do you anticipate greater difficulties in collecting the tax as a result of the economic slowdown? Did you experience that in 2001-2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, we are seeing, of course, more people who owe money who are unable to pay it because they aren't working. And so we will see some impact on who we're able to collect from, on obligations that we have. But we looked back to the downturn, the 2001 to 2003 time frame, and our collection effectiveness on a per employee basis did not appear to be significantly reduced. Who you collect from shifts. But the effectiveness of the employees was not significantly adversely affected.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in line with Representative Benz, a question that I'm also a little bit hesitant to ask, but because it might be a foolish one, but I was interested in your opening comments about the two sort of stories, and one that seemed more inadvertent and one that's a bit more intentional. Is there any information that would allow us to think about how much is intentional and how much is inadvertent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, if we knew that, we would be using very different strategies. The reasons why taxpayers don't report all their liability runs the gamut from they didn't know better they were confused, and I have another little story that I would tell you. It's in the report about confusion around lottery winnings. They are overwhelmed by something else that's going on in their life, illness in the family, death of a partner or a child, divorce, loss of a job, that just trying to then do the tax compliance, it just is one more thing they're not able to cope with, a fire that destroys records, all the way through to, well, if I claim a few more charitable contributions, it isn't going to hurt anybody, to I'm not filing, I'm staying underground, I'm dealing in cash, I don't want to deal with the government. They've got the whole range. So motivation is one thing. Everybody, the only document we have is a return or a lack of a return, and then some third-party information that helps us try to identify who maybe should be filing. So that one's just very, very difficult.
I suspected that might be the case, but I appreciate
the human condition.
I appreciate hearing the thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm watching the time, so I.
And I'm very interested in the material that you've got in the next several slides,
okay,
because that looks like very interesting data.
Okay, so our net gap, we think, is our compliance level is somewhere between 80% and 85%, if all the assumptions that we made are accurate, and we just are. It's an estimate. It's our best estimate based on what we know, without perfect information. Here are some of the things we learned, and again, we did a survey through Oregon State. There's a summary, the executive summary of the survey is in the big report in an appendix. A lot more information about the calculation of the compliance percentage is also in Appendix C in the report. And I know I don't have time to go through that with you today, but I'm happy to come back and talk about focus things as you're considering other issues. These first items are related to either information we've got or things we learned through the OSU survey. The respondents to that survey said that they believe that not paying taxes is something that's serious, that it's up there with some even criminal behavior. And generally those folks believe that people will be caught if they cheat by a large amount. Our own data tells us that over 40% of taxpayers use paid preparers, particularly if they're filing the long form. And that to us is a direct reflection on the complexity of the system. I've already mentioned third-party verification of income or deductions really, really affects compliance, and I've got a slide that will show you that. And withholding, the single smallest area percentage of noncompliance is on wages and salaries. 1.2% was what the IRS said is not reported, and definitely the smallest group. We heard from that survey that we need to be perceived as more aggressive in tax enforcement, that our effectiveness, it's kind of like when you puff up really big, people think you're really big. The more visible we are, the more that maybe influences people who might be on the fence about, should I try to really under-report my taxes or not. And we also need to continue to increase our enforcement efforts, and I think really more around the diversity of tools that we use and when we use them. Taxpayers comply, I think I've kind of gone over that just a little bit, from everything from they understand that taxes are the way we pay for services we can't provide for ourselves alone, to they're going to find out, so I better not do it. This is shows you that from the federal perspective, and these dollar numbers are the federal dollars and percentages, based on what we call the visibility of income items. The high visibility items, obviously, wages and salaries, and they're subject to with third-party reporting, they're subject to withholding, and so a very, very high degree of compliance for those types of income. The medium high category is, I've got scribbled notes everywhere here, the interest in dividends, pensions, unemployment income, 1099s are issued, but withholding is optional for some of those categories, and there's no withholding in others. And you see that the non-compliance is creeping up on those items. But once again, as taxpayers believe we know what they have, they're still more likely to report it. When you get into income amounts where there's only some information reporting and it's incomplete, the non-compliance percentage goes up again. That's flow-through entities, capital gains on securities, alimony income are some examples there, and it begins to, you start to see a very significant increase in the non-compliance. And then when you get into those that are very low visibility, where we have no information coming other than from the taxpayer, whether it's net business income, net farm income, other kinds of capital gains where there's not a 1099, other gains that occur, rental payments, some royalty payments, some other kinds of income, it's invisible to us because we just don't have any information to tell us about it. And the amounts that at least the IRS believe are not being reported really begin to grow. This table is our extrapolation back of the, and again now the column that says misreporting percentage is actually the non-compliant side. And this is in the visibility categories and gives you a sense of sort of the percentages. The column on the right, the number of Oregon returns, kind of shows you the size of the haystacks that we would have to go through to find those needles. Wages and salaries are reported on almost every Oregon return. 1.2 million of the 2006 returns reported wages and salaries. And you can see the return counts for those income items. If we can only touch 33,000 or so returns a year with the audit resources we have today, and we need to spread it across a variety of return issues, we are not going to be able to look at every return, and in some cases, not even a significant proportion of the returns that might have the issue. And we need to find new ways of, even though they won't have glowing ink on them, of zeroing in on the higher risk types of items and returns to focus our energy and attention.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair Burdick.
Are you on these low visibility things? Do you have the, and this may just show my ignorance in this field, but do you have the ability to, for example, get just single out returns that have some of these low visibility items on them and audit just those? Or are you committed once you pick out a return to audit the whole thing? I mean, do you have a way of narrowing down your audit to the lower visibility areas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the answer to your question is we have a lot of flexibility in how we focus our audit efforts. We can choose to focus on issues. So we have had projects in the past where we've tried to focus on partnership issues. Way back in the 80s, when tax shelters were the way to reduce federal liability, we had a group of people that did nothing but look at tax shelter adjustments. And so we do focus on issues in returns. In other cases, the auditor will look at pretty much everything on the return, federal as well as state issues. And so we vary that and try to have some strategies and direction. And we've focused most recently on self-employed business and partnership as a set of issues for quite a bit of the resource. But at the same time, we don't want to zero in so much that we ignore others, nor do we want to appear to be targeting a very, very narrow group of taxpayers to the exclusion of everybody else. It's a balancing a balancing act for us and over time, and it's really mostly based on the amount of resource.
Well, and I understand that, Mr. Chairman, but it's kind of like the Willie Horton approach. You know, you need to go where he robbed banks because that's where the money was. And if you look at some of these areas where you have a high misreporting percentage and also a high number of returns, it would seem only logical that you would maybe turn your auditors to some of these, tell them to skip the rest of the return and just focus on more returns in these areas where you have a high percentage of misreporting and a high number of returns, like rents, royalties, you know, over half misreporting. I say that because I'm in that category. And 204,000 returns. So it would seem to me that would make sense to go to some of those areas. And I do realize I have the warped perspective of a revenue chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, one more piece of information that influenced those choices. As you look across a range of returns that have a particular income item, another thing we would look at would be how much of that income item is reflected there. And if the amount of rental income, for example, is relatively small, so that even if half of it were misreported, the amount of tax would not be as much as the cost of doing the audit, we're likely to set aside that return and focus on an audit where we know that the cost that we put in is more likely to come back out again. So there's that dimension as well of looking at everything that has rental income. There may be some that are small and some that are large, and we would probably tend to focus on the larger ones. But we don't want to neglect any particular category completely, because then the community of taxpayers isn't being treated as objectively as we feel that they should be, and we don't want to neglect any particular area. So it's a balancing act. This is an area where when you see our recommendations, you'll see that we know we need to do some work, much more strategic and intentional about how we select audits and what information that we use in order to do that, and whether we use the strategy that you described, which we do for in some instances, focus on an issue and not try and do the entire return, but just hit the issue and touch more returns. So all those strategies are in the mix. Absolutely.
Thank you.
I knew I was going to run behind. So for the Oregon only or Oregon specific, we had to make some assumptions about whether the reporting would be similar, the compliance levels or understatement levels would be similar to federal. We made that assumption for like kinds of items. And the Oregon additions, for example, we have an add back for interest on bonds that Oregonian holds that are from other states. It's excluded for federal purposes. It's taxable in Oregon. Other add backs because there's a federal credit that's related, no, federal deduction that's related, that for which Oregon provides a credit. So we add back and then we provide the credit instead of the deduction. So there's the possibility of misstatement of those items. Social Security. Not taxable in Oregon, taxable at the federal level. So that's what some of those additions and subtractions are. Itemized and standard deduction, some are subject to floors. They have to be at least 2% of your federal before you can deduct them. Sometimes people deduct the whole thing. They don't go through that floor measuring. And then Oregon credits. Some people will claim that they've had more withholding than they've actually had. Claiming exemption credits for maybe a child who isn't in a household or a child for whom the taxpayer isn't providing more than half the support. And then refundable credits, I talked about that just a little bit. We do have some real focus on making sure we aren't sending out erroneous refundable credits. Again, we've got pretty good sized haystacks in which to try to find those needles. So here's what we're doing right now. To try to improve compliance, we are trying to match our response to the way taxpayers are behaving. If it looks like they're making mistakes simply because they don't have enough information, We will work with them if, when we identify them and say you've got a problem and we need to fix it, whether it's filing a return or adjusting taxes due, they're willing to work with us, we're willing to work with them, and we will use pay plans and other tools to get them into compliance and keep them there. And if they're not, we've got some enforcement tools that we use. I've talked to you about education and assistance, and that we try to cover telephone, web, community, and taxpayer groups. The fourth bullet here is a significant one. We have a program that we call CP2000, where the IRS sends us information, third-party information that they have that they've captured in their data sets, and we use that. If it's got an Oregon taxpayer address, we can use that information to make sure that the information was reported. And I mentioned those compliance focus areas, the recent compliance focus areas, partnerships and flow-through entities, cash-based business. Some of our challenges, until right now, we've had a lot of turnover in our audit staff. People are sticking to their jobs, and we've not seen the turnover that we've had over the last several years recently, but that's been an issue for us, because it takes a while for them to become really truly proficient, especially for audits that look at business schedules or farm schedules. Our systems really are, as I said, they are heavy duty, but they have not been adjustable to really provide case management and selection, and that's an area where we know we need to do some work. On collection and filing enforcement, we've done quite a bit of work thinking about that process, and are starting to retool, identify some new tools. We've got a policy option package in the governor's budget to invest the funds for automated call distributor that would allow agents to work with more people and become more productive. And we're also looking at the way we use private collection firms right now, and seeing if we can't send debts out more quickly and expand our total resource of collectors. Some of the challenges, once again, our systems are not as up to date as they need to be. We have had staff turnover, and taxpayers, we do rely on the fact that there are penalties and there is interest for understating or not paying to be a motivator for taxpayers, and if they don't know about it, it's not a motivator. So we have that issue. We've also recognize that, and we knew all along, we didn't have the resources to detect or prevent criminal tax frauds. And it's very, very labor-intensive. We have worked with the Department of Justice on a case recently where there was a conviction for someone who was paying people basically cash, not reporting anything, not withholding taxes. And we're using that to publicizing that to remind employers that they need to be doing what the law requires them to do. The other big issue is confidentiality of taxpayer information, and we'll be talking to you about giving us some freedom, subject to some constraints, to protect taxpayer information, but to share just a little bit more with some of our partners so that we can line up our enforcement efforts more effectively. We did a best practices survey with other states and the IRS, and these are some examples of some of the best practices. There's a much more extensive list in the written report, but we need to be analyzing information using what, you know, is variously called business intelligence data warehouse, but basically it's getting a lot more information and using it very, very in a sophisticated way to understand better how to manage better our collections workload, automate some self-service options for taxpayers, pay plans, online pay plans. We've provided a direct debit service just in January for people to be able to have us pull out of a checking account or a savings account a payment, and that's working very, very well. We've had recommendations from other states about using data matching with bank account information to find assets to satisfy debt using more third-party information. So the best practices are the things that we know we need to do and we're beginning to work on. Recommendations. There are some things now that we know that we can do without additional resource and where we don't need a policy change from you, and we're underway. How we use the private collectors, extending the hours our own collectors work, giving them some flexibility in their schedule, but also allowing us to contact taxpayers during a little broader range of hours. We've already been engaging in a public information campaign with employers to protect the withholding program. As the economy continues to degrade, the option for employers to consider borrowing the withholdings that they've taken from their employees' pay and using that for business expense rather than sending it in, that just that temptation goes up. So we've been reminding employers to not do that and the consequences. Again, this, you've seen the theme, third-party information, continuing to gather and use that, improving our audit methods and our training and working with licensing boards to increase compliance. Looking for ways to increase compliance by state contractors. Currently, they have to attest that they are in compliance, but there's not a check for that. We want to develop some tools for schools to use and a policy option package around criminal prosecution for next session. Looking at our core systems, that is part of our transformation work. Is we've got those systems. We know they need to be replaced. What are we going to replace them with? What's the capacity that we need to have? And then last session, you passed a bill requiring reporting and withholding on real estate transactions where a non-resident was the property owner. We've only just now got 1 year of data on that. We want to continue to analyze it and come back with an evaluation of that program and considerations for you whether it should be expanded. Policy changes. The big one, I think, is disclosure authority for us that this committee can help us with. Expanding our ability to share information with licensing boards in anticipation of creating a proposal for 2011 of a condition of getting a license, of demonstrably being in compliance or being able to renew. Working with those practitioner boards to continue to curtail unlicensed, uneducated practitioners from giving bad advice to taxpayers, because we've been seeing some of that. Working with state and local law enforcement on pursuing tax crimes, and again, working with the banking industry on matching data for collections. We will be coming back in 2011 with some more fully developed proposals related to licensing and state contractors and the withholding withholding on the real estate transactions program. And you asked about our budget. For now, we do have a policy option package in the governor's budget. It proposes the addition of 44 positions related to the collection function and filing enforcement function. The cost is about $6.374 million, and we expect to generate just over $19 million of general fund for a net revenue generation of 12.8. So that gives you an idea. At least now we still are, you invest a dollar, you get well more than a dollar back. But we continue to believe that the most efficient dollar is the dollar that gets somebody to do it right the first time.
And may I ask, this is the direct receipt.
Correct.
It doesn't have anything to do with the increased compliance by other taxpayers.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. This is just the direct measure, what we believe is the measurable revenue that would be generated by the activities of those new positions.
Right. If you audit a return and there's an increased tax liability which is paid, that's the number we're talking about.
Well, actually, it's collection. This is a collection function.
Right.
And so it's...
Oh, I see.
It's the taxpayers who owe the money and haven't paid it.
Right.
And it's getting that in the door more quickly. And also on the filing enforcement side, person who hasn't filed.
Right.
And what that liability is.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to leave right away, but I have one quick question, and I wanted to know where you believe the point of
diminishing
returns is how many people if we had a huge budget that we could draw on and give you all the people you want, where do you think that is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we know that we haven't hit it, and we're fairly certain that it's out there quite a ways. going back to the data on the numbers of returns that have some of those high risk items on them, we have about 100 tax auditors today doing not only the in-person one-on-one face-to-face audits, but also processing the more efficient reports that we already get from the Internal Revenue Service. If we double the number of auditors, we would maybe add another 33,000 audits. So it's you'd have to build me a new building to get to a point where we put a dollar in and only got a dollar out. We have not in our belief touched the bottom or the larger number of people who don't file and should be filing. And we've got about 100 people working in that program. So there's, I don't think we're at all close to that yet.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, also commenting on Representative Call's question, we would like to be sure that as we go through discussions with you as well as discussions with Ways and Means, that we can agree on a method for measuring that return. At this point in time, we do measure direct return attributed to our collectors, our auditors, and the specialists who work on filing enforcement. The ranges, depending upon the nature of the work, are a dollar in, $4 out, to a dollar in, $9 out. And it really depends on sort of the nature of the activity and the efficiency with which people are able to work. But there is the marginal dollar that we add, especially if it's for face-to-face work, isn't going to produce the same return as a dollar that we add that allows us to develop interventions and change people's behavior without having to talk to them one-on-one. And so we were trying to find where that balance is, and of course it's always moving, but that's why the continuous improvement and good analytics are what we need to invest in. So this is the preview of coming attractions. We think that we're going to need to invest in and develop a way to analyze a lot more information, provide return process and automated system for partnership returns so that we're better able to flag audit issues there. We want to work with the licensing boards, particularly the Tax Practitioners Board. We have had folks who are not licensed who advertise that they can reduce your taxes by, 50%, and taxpayers are taken in by that, and then they're the ones that are left holding the bag. So we want to continue to help with that consumer protection and compliance strategy. We'll be working with Department of Justice on how we might do a little bit more around criminal tax prosecution. And we think it's important for us to continue to survey taxpayers about how we're doing and what we're doing and not do that once in a generation. So, policy option package. Am I going backwards? I am going backwards.
You are, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Next. So, it's hard to measure it. A lot of factors contribute to it. We have some good, when I talk to you, I talk to you about what we need to do to improve, but our base, I think, is sound. We are making a difference. I think we affect that non-compliance by about 8 to 10% of it. We need to look for ways to have a bigger impact. I don't think we're ever going to get everybody to be fully perfectly compliant just because of the nature of the system and that taxpayers really do have to be the ones that take that burden on. But we can do more, and we really do need to work with you and want to work with you on what we do and how we do it. So So I really appreciate your patience and your time. And there is a lot more, and I'm happy to come back or visit with you individually, whatever works best for you.
Great. Yes, thank you. I would suggest that members who have specific questions should direct them directly to the director or the staff that normally are at the committee. I really appreciate this. The one additional suggestion I would have, which you may be in contemplating, and that is to figure out a way in which you're going to use the general news media as a means of advertising compliance efforts. You know, the classic example is the perp walk of the tax avoider who is going to prison because of the failure to pay taxes, and that's a great motivator for some people in that group who are afraid of being caught.
Mm-hmm.
Having some large profile cases may be useful at some point. There's been a case in the newspaper recently involving a very well-known activist in Oregon who apparently has used a nonprofit as a way of disguising income. And I don't know whether he's paid his taxes or not, but that might be something that the department might want to look into. And if it were the case, might generate some positive publicity on the compliance level. Anything else for the good of the order today,
Mr. Chair? I just want to ask whether this whole process of going through
just 1 second before the last of my members leave. I want to remind you that we're going to recess in a minute and we'll be reconvening at 2:00 for our additional meeting today. Thank you. Go ahead.
I didn't mean to hold everybody up, but no. I just wanted to find out if this was a valuable exercise to you, whether this just the fact of doing this report and doing this analysis had value beyond just informing us what's going on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, absolutely. Absolutely. It was a tremendous amount of effort and energy. I had a core team of 6 or 7 people who have worked on this for the bulk of the time between February and now, and then dozens of others who have touched it in different ways. We've gathered a lot of information. We've thought about how this fits with the vision that we've developed and the strategies that we need to implement going forward. It's provided some tremendous insights for us. We've actually had validation that some of the things that we're doing are really, really good things and that they are effective, and we've learned that there are some additional things that we can do that are working well in other states and that where it's been pretty fairly well fleshed out and we can integrate reasonably easily. So the discipline that was necessary to be able to report was a great value. The focus was very timely. Even more looking back from today, very, very timely and helpful to have you reinforce how important it is for the legislature for us to be looking at the general issue of compliance and what influences it so that we can inform your deliberations as well as our own administration of tax programs. So it was extremely helpful. It did not feel like make work at all. It really is core to what we need to do going forward. So the timing was excellent.
Thank you. I hope you feel free to share some of your conclusions here with the Ways and Means Committee. I think it would be valuable.
I'm sure it will be a topic of conversation. It already has been.
Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to recess until 2:00 when we'll pick up our afternoon agenda. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.